From NPR News, this is a special report. The confirmation of federal judge Sonia Sotomayor to sit on the Supreme Court. If she is confirmed, she will be the first person of Hispanic descent to become a justice of the United States. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and this is the second day of Judge Sotomayor's confirmation hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Today, the questioning began with each member of the committee allowed 30 minutes of conversation with the nominee. Some senators seemed to attempt to provoke the nominee, but the chairman, who goes first, did not. Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, used his half hour to lob a few softballs right over the plate. He asked Judge Sotomayor about a famous murder case she prosecuted in New York, the so-called Tarzan murder case, while she was working for the longtime district attorney, Robert Morgenthau. Sotomayor said first that the experience of working for Morgenthau made her a lawyer. "I owe what I've become," she said, "to Mr. Morgenthau." She explained the case which led to the conviction of Roger Maddox and also, she said, taught her something which might be called empathy for victims, although she didn't use that word.
That case brought to life for me in a way that perhaps no other case had fully done before the tragic consequences of needless death. In that case, Mr. Maddox was dubbed the Tarzan murderer by the press because he used acrobatic feats to gain entry into apartments. In one case, he took a rope, placed it on a pipe on top of a roof, put a paint can at the other end and threw it into a window in a building below and broke the window. He then swung himself into the apartment and on the other side shot a person he found. He did that repeatedly, and as a result, he destroyed families. I saw a family that had been intact, with a mother living with three of her children, some grandchildren. They all worked at various jobs. Some were going to school. They stood as they watched one of their, the mother stood as she watched one of her children be struck by a bullet that Mr. Maddox fired and killed him because the bullet struck the middle of his head. That family was destroyed. They scattered to the four winds, and only one brother remained in New York who could testify. That case taught me that prosecutors, as all participants in the justice system, must be sensitive to the price that crime imposes on our entire society.
Continuing to give the nominee a chance to go first on issues which Republican colleagues might be expected to bring up, Chairman Leahy offered Sotomayor an opportunity to explain her statement about the now famous wise Latina. The entire quote is, "I would hope that a wise Latina woman with the richness of her experiences would more often than not reach a better conclusion than a white male who has not lived that life." Leahy said some public commentators have called that comment racist.
So tell us, you've heard all these charges and countercharges, the wise Latina and on. Here's your chance. You tell us what's going on here, Judge.
Thank you for giving me an opportunity to explain my remarks. Words I have ever spoken or written have received so much attention. I gave a variant of my speech to a variety of different groups, most often to groups of women lawyers or to groups, most particularly, of young Latino lawyers and students. As my speech made clear in one of the quotes that you reference, I was trying to inspire them to believe that their life experiences would enrich the legal system because different life experiences and backgrounds always do. I don't think that there is a quarrel with that in our society. I was also in trying to inspire them to believe that they could become anything they wanted to become, just as I had. The context of the words that I spoke have created a misunderstanding, and I want a misunderstanding, and to give everyone assurances, I want to state up front, unequivocally and without doubt, I do not believe that any ethnic, racial, or gender group has an advantage in sound judging. I do believe that every person has an equal opportunity to be a good and wise judge, regardless of their background or life experiences. The words that I used agreeing with the sentiment that Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was attempting to convey. I understood that sentiment to be what I just spoke about, which is that both men and women were equally capable of being wise and fair judges.
The quote attributed to retired Justice Sandra Day O'Connor actually originated with the late Minnesota Supreme Court Justice Jean Coyne. Justice Coyne said, "A wise old man and a wise old woman often reach the same conclusion." Both Justice O'Connor and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg have quoted that line. The ranking Republican member of the committee, Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, pressed Sotomayor on the Latina quote and on other things she said in speeches and comments off the bench, pressing her on the importance of background, experiences, biases and prejudices, on impartiality. "I would just note," Senator Sessions said, "that it's not just one sentence, as my chairman suggested, that causes our difficulty. It's a body of thought over a period of years." And he brought up other quotes. Here's a portion of the exchange with Senator Sessions.
"So first, I'd like to know, do you think there's any circumstance in which a judge should allow their prejudices to impact their decision-making?"
"Never their prejudices. I was talking about the very important goal of the justice system is to ensure that the personal biases and prejudices of a judge do not influence the outcome of a case. What I was talking about was the obligation of judges to examine what they're feeling as they're adjudicating a case and to ensure that that's not influencing the outcome. Life experiences have to influence you. We're not robots to listen to evidence and don't have feelings. We have to recognize those feelings and put them aside. That's what my speech was saying.
Well, Judge,
that's our job."
"But the statement was, I willingly accept that we who judge must not deny the differences resulting from experience and heritage, but continuously to judge when those opinions, sympathies, and prejudices are appropriate." That's exactly opposite of what you're saying, is it not?
"I don't believe so, Senator, because all I was saying is, because we have feelings and different experiences, we can be led to believe that our experiences are appropriate. We have to be open-minded to accept that they may not be, and that we have to judge always that we're not letting those things determine the outcome. But there are situations in which some experiences are important in the process of judging because the law asked us to use those experiences."
"Well, I understand that, but let me just follow up that you say in your statement that you want to do what you can to increase the faith in the impartiality of our system, but isn't it true this statement suggests that you accept that there may be sympathies, prejudices, and opinions that legitimately can influence a judge's decision, and how can that further faith in the impartiality of the system?"
"I think the system is strengthened when judges don't assume they're impartial, but when judges test themselves to identify when their emotions are driving a result or their experiences are driving a result, and the law is not.
I agree with that. I know one judge that says that if he has a feeling about a case, he tells his law clerks to watch me. I do not want my biases, sympathies, or prejudices to influence this decision, which I've taken an oath to make sure is impartial. I just am very concerned that what you're saying today is quite inconsistent with your statement that you willingly accept that your sympathies, opinions, and prejudices may influence your decision-making.
In the end, Judge Sotomayor offered something like an apology for her standard speech remark about the wise Latina. Justice O'Connor's repetition of the remark that a wise old man and a wise old woman would reach the same conclusion.
I also, as I explained, was using a rhetorical flourish that fell flat. I knew that Justice O'Connor couldn't have meant that if judges reach different conclusions, legal conclusions, that one of them wasn't wise. That couldn't have been her meaning, because reasonable judges disagree on legal conclusions in some cases. So I was trying to play on her words. My play fell flat. It was bad, because it left an impression that I believed that life experiences commanded a result in a case, but that's clearly not what I do as a judge. It's clearly not what I intended. In the context of my broader speech, which was attempting to inspire young Hispanic, Latino students and lawyers to believe that their life experiences added value to the process.
Decisions in court, Judge Sotomayor repeatedly said today, are for her commanded by the law and the facts. Coming up, Judge Sotomayor on Roe v. Wade. By the way, anti-abortion demonstrators continued to disrupt the hearing today, but very briefly. A substantial contingent of Capitol Police swiftly ejected one demonstrator, so swiftly that it was done before Chairman Pat Leahy finished calling for it to be done. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and you are listening to a special report from NPR News. Welcome back. You're listening to a special program from NPR News. Hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the nomination of Judge Sonia Sotomayor to be a Justice of the United States and to be the first Hispanic person to serve on the Supreme Court. I'm Linda Wertheimer. During today's lengthy session, senators were each given 30 minutes to ask questions of the nominee. Many of the questions were technical questions of law. Many of the judge's responses were not exactly answers to the questions, instead telling the senators that she could not speak to those questions because cases are working their way toward the high court dealing with those issues, and therefore answers would not be appropriate. Senator Herb Cole of Wisconsin asked a question early on about abortion. Does Judge Sotomayor consider that legal abortion is now a settled issue in law?
Judge, the court's ruling about the right to privacy in Griswold laid the foundation for Roe versus Wade. In your opinion, is Roe settled law?
The court's decision in Planned Parenthood versus Casey reaffirmed the core holding of Roe. That is the precedent of the court and settled in terms of the holding of the court.
Do you agree with Justices Souter, O'Connor, and Kennedy in their opinion in Casey, which reaffirmed the core holding in Roe?
As I said, Casey reaffirmed the holding in Roe. That is the Supreme Court's settled interpretation of what the core holding is and its reaffirmance of it.
As you will have noticed, Judge Sotomayor says that it is the precedent that is settled. We'll give that a closer read in just a few minutes. Later in the afternoon, abortion and Roe v. Wade came up again, this time in a question from Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who began by telling the nominee that he is still disturbed by some of her comments off the bench, including comments in speeches. "We want to know what we're getting," he said, and he peppered the nominee with questions, including this one.
Do you think Roe v. Wade changed American society?
Roe versus Wade looked at the Constitution and decided that the Constitution, as applied to a claimed right, applied.
Is there anything in the Constitution that says a state legislator or the Congress cannot regulate abortion or the definition of life in the first trimester?
The holding of the court as...
I'm asking the Constitution. Does the Constitution as written prohibit a legislative body at the state or federal level from defining life or regulating the rights of the unborn or protecting the rights of the unborn in the first trimester?
The Constitution in the 14th Amendment has a...
Is there anything in the document written about abortion?
The word abortion is not used in the Constitution, but the Constitution does have a broad provision concerning a liberty provision under the due process.
And that gets us to the speeches.
We have some people sitting here in the studio who can help us with some of these technicalities. Nina Totenberg is NPR's legal affairs correspondent. Nina, could you give us your take on what the nominee actually said about abortion?
Nothing. Now, she, like all nominees to the Supreme Court that I have ever watched, does not want to talk about abortion. But I think it's fair to say that Senator Graham caught her slightly off guard, and that she wanted to talk about the broad provisions in the Constitution, not about Roe versus Wade. She wanted to dance around Robin Hood's barn, as my mother used to say, to use an old-fashioned expression. And he didn't want her to do that, but of course, in the end, these people don't get nominated to the Supreme Court because they're stupid. And in a contest between a senator, even a pretty smart senator, and a nominee, especially a nominee who's talking slowly, she can wear them down.
Tom Goldstein blogs about the court. You can read his work on scotusblog.com. He's also an attorney at the firm of Akin Gump here in Washington. I should say he's a partner at the law firm. Tommy, does that tell you anything? Anything revealed?
Well, I might dissent just the tiniest little bit. There were a few exchanges on abortion, one of which was from Dianne Feinstein, who is very concerned about preserving a line of cases when Sandra Day O'Connor was on the Supreme Court saying you can't have an abortion regulation that doesn't have an exception for the health of the mother. And the Roberts Court has headed away from that, giving states more power to regulate abortion. And she asked Judge Sotomayor about these two, the old line of cases with O'Connor and the new ones. And Judge Sotomayor interestingly tried to reconcile the two and say, no, even with the new decisions, the old precedent saying you have to have an exception for the health of the mother remains settled law. And that's not saying a lot, but it is an indication that she does have is in the camp of a broader reading of Roe.
She seemed to be making some sort of a distinction between the Roberts ruling in what was it? It was
Carhartt, the partial birth abortion case. Exactly. And saying that, yeah, even with that decision, well, she's sort of hoisting the Roberts Court by its own petard because it had refused to overrule the old case. And it had said that the cases could all be reconciled. And so Judge Sotomayor says, okay, that's what you say. Well, then the old cases remain good law, and I will stick with them.
Tom, I think we agree.
Okay. Excellent.
It's a detail. Okay. Now, here's another area of the law which is being debated in a number of places, including the Congress and the courts, and that is the signing statement. President George W. Bush made a practice of signing legislation that Congress passed. Now, generally, that means the bill becomes a law in the civics lesson sense of the word, but President Bush would often add a signing statement saying that he did not agree with certain things in the new law, and therefore he would not consider those bits of the new law to be law. Senator Dianne Feinstein of California asked about signing statements. She specifically mentioned the example of a ban on torture passed by Congress.
Does the Constitution authorize the president to not follow parts of laws duly passed by the Congress that he is willing to sign, that he believes are an unconstitutional infringement on executive authority?
Judge Sotomayor did not speak to that question exactly, saying that there are a number of claims in various courts that the president has exceeded congressional authorization or exceeded his own powers, and that would prevent her from speaking. Instead, she went back for some history.
The best expression of how to address this always in a particular situation was made by Justice Jackson in his concurrence in the Youngstown Steele seizure cases. And that involved President Truman's seizure of Steele factories. There, Justice Jackson has sort of set off the framework in an articulation that no one's thought of a better way to make it. He says that you always have to look at an assertion by the president that he or she is acting within executive power in the context of what Congress has done or not done. And he always starts with, first you look at whether Congress has expressly or implicitly addressed or authorized the president to act in a certain way. And if the president has, then he's acting at his highest stature of power. If the president is acting in prohibition of an express or implied act of Congress, then he's working at his lowest ebbs. If he's acting where Congress hasn't spoken, then we're in what Justice Jackson called the zone of twilight. The issue in any particular case is always starting with what Congress says or has not said, and then looking at what the Constitution has says about the powers of the president minus Congress's powers in that area. You can't speak more specifically than that in response to your statement that were part of your question, other than to say the president can't act in violation of the Constitution. No one's above the law.
NPR's senior Washington editor Ron Elving is with us again to talk about what is happening with the Sotomayor nomination. Ron, signing statements, this was a sort of a special province of George W. Bush. Do signing statements continue to be a concern in Congress or in the country?
They certainly do among some people. There are some folks who are still very much concerned about the signing statement, where it may be going, what precedents may have been set in the Bush years. And Barack Obama has used it a half a dozen times already. He has also issued a careful statement about exactly when he will and won't use a signing statement, but of course reserving to himself the prerogative of using it, as past presidents have done. Let's be clear about this. I mean, these go back to James Monroe in the 1820s. They've been around for a very long time. They've been used by many, many presidents in a number of different ways. And Bill Clinton, in his years in the 1990s, issued far more signing statements than George W. Bush did, even though Bush got much more notorious for it. He did about 140, I think, by the count of the American Presidency Project. And many of them made reference to this thing, which he had borrowed from Ronald Reagan's signing statements, that referred to the unitary power of the executive, or the unitary authority of the executive, which strongly implied that Congress couldn't mess with a certain core of constitutional prerogatives that lay with the executive branch, suggesting, too, that if Congress tried to tell him who he could interrogate, how, and what he had to reveal about what was going on in the administration during the war on terrorism, or any number of other things that affected the military in particular, then that law was null and void. He didn't have to enforce it or execute it under his normal oath to execute faithfully all laws.
There is one difference with the Bush signing statements, and that is that presidents are very jealous of their own powers. So, for example, when Jimmy Carter signed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, he said there may be occasions when I don't have to do this. But he didn't say what Bush said in a lot of instances, which is, I won't abide by certain provisions of this law because I think they invade my prerogatives.
So the question of signing statements, she didn't really answer that question. She just gave a sort of a loose interpretation of the constitutional powers that the president has versus the the Congress.
Well, if she's really lucky, she'll never have to rule on it.
Yeah, and on so many of these issues, what you have is senators who have their own pet issues. And so they're not really asking what Sonia, they don't really care what Sonia Sotomayor thinks about this and can't imagine she would ever answer the question. But each of them has things that they care about and they want to get out onto the airwaves and they know the public cares about them. And this is really an excuse to talk about them.
I don't think we can pay too much attention to the fact that these senators are speaking to people in the room and to people on the other side of that camera, as opposed to Sonia Sotomayor, or each other, for that matter. This is largely about getting out a message that each one of them has carefully calibrated with their staffs for what they want to get out of these 3, 4, 5 days.
One of the things that that we're going to be talking about in a few minutes is the takings, which was a special interest of Senator Charles Grassley, who was very concerned. Apparently, his Iowa farmers are very concerned about the possibility that the federal government could get in there and take away some of their farmland. I also was wondering what you think about the idea that this business of not answering questions, is that a problem in terms of, obviously it's a problem for her to answer them in terms of having to consider them on the court, but how big a problem is that?
Well, you know, the only nominee who really answered questions a lot was Robert Bork, and he didn't get confirmed. Now, he was in a situation that most nominees since him have not been in. He had written an enormous amount off the bench that was very controversial, and he couldn't not answer questions about that. And to add insult to injury, he didn't do any moot courts. The White House suggested perhaps they might do some mock interrogations. No, he didn't want to do that. So he came to the hearings, and my recollection is there were 5 days of hearings in which he was on the witness stand, and he answered a great deal, sometimes actually saying things that were somewhat different than what he'd written, in which case he was accused of a confirmation conversion, and otherwise he was accused of being an extremist. And you see the results. He was defeated by a substantial margin.
Now, I just want to take notice of the fact that tonight is the All-Star Game, and baseball did come up in the hearings today, and not just balls and strikes, as we've heard several for the first day. Senator Charles Schumer of New York raised perhaps the most prominent case on which Judge Sotomayor has ever ruled.
We've heard a lot of discussions about baseball in metaphorical terms. Judges as umpires. We had a lot of that yesterday, a little of that today. But I want to talk about baseball a little more concretely. First, am I correct you share my love for America's pastime?
It's often said that I grew up in the shadow of Yankee Stadium.
Yes, well,
to be more accurate, I grew up sitting next to my dad while he was alive watching baseball.
Okay.
And it's one of my fondest memories of him.
So given that you live near Yankee Stadium and you're from the Bronx, I was going to ask you, are you a Mets or Yankee fan? But I guess you've answered that, right?
Be careful. You want to keep the chairman on your side.
No. As much as Judge Scalia might want to be nominated, I don't think she would adapt the Red Sox as her team, as you have, Mr. Chairman. Judge Sotomayor, I'm sorry. Who did I say? Oh. I don't know who Judge Scalia roots for, but I know who Judge Sotomayor roots for.
I know many residents of Washington, D.C. have asked me to look at the senators for a while.
Okay, let you know that this was a little more cordial than we have perhaps made it appear, and we did have the occasional light moment. The baseball ruling, though, that was a very big ruling for her. Can anybody talk about that?
Well, she does take tremendous pride in it, and this discussion really was a kind of all-American moment, including the reference to her father, who hasn't really taken center stage, her late father, who died when she was relatively young. But this was a case about a lockout in baseball, and she was a trial judge, and she ended the lockout. And so you can just tell from the way she smiles in talking about this case that baseball is really near and dear to her heart, and I do think for those folks who were paying close attention to the hearings, it gave them a more personal sense of her as when she gets really invested and is genuinely proud in the outcome of the cases, which isn't very often. She tries to come across as a highly technical judge who takes each case as it comes to her, but this was obviously something she probably regards as the highlight of her career.
And if she gets confirmed, she's going to be have to go to Washington Nationals games, and that doesn't have quite the same level of baseball as the Yankees or the Mets, for that matter.
She can come watch them play the Yankees.
There you
well,
go.
Well, and you can say the Washington Nationals are carrying on the tradition of the Washington Senators, which she apparently remembers.
Yes. Well, Ron Elving, Nina Totenberg, Tom Goldstein, stick around, because we're going to be back with more analysis and one of the liveliest and perhaps least pleasant exchanges of the day. You are listening to a special report from NPR News. Here we are again, and you're listening to a special report from NPR News on hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the nomination to the Supreme Court of Federal Judge Sonia Sotomayor. I'm Linda Wertheimer. The judge and the committee sat down together first thing this morning and worked steadily through the day with only a few brief breaks, some time for lunch. Each senator had 30 minutes in which to ask questions. Eight senators still have not taken their turn, but the whole thing will come back tomorrow. Today's discussion included many attempts by senators to pin down Judge Sotomayor on specific issues, often on relatively obscure points of law. But late in the afternoon, Judge Sotomayor and Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina had a fairly spirited conversation about judicial temperament, and it sounded friendly at the beginning.
Now, let's talk about you. I like you, by the way, for whatever that matters. Since I may vote for you, that ought to matter to you. One thing that stood out about your record is that when you look at the almanac of the federal judiciary, lawyers anonymously rate judges in terms of temperament. And here's what they said about you. She's a terror on the bench. She's temperamental, excitable. She seems angry. She's overly aggressive, not very judicial. She does not have a very good temperament. She abuses lawyers. She really lacks judicial temperament. She behaves in an out-of-control manner. She makes inappropriate outbursts. She is nasty to lawyers. She will attack lawyers for making an argument she does not like. She can be a bit of a bully. When you look at the evaluation of the judges on the Second Circuit, you stand out like a sore thumb in terms of your temperament. What is your answer to these criticisms?
I do ask tough questions at oral argument.
Are you the only one that asks tough questions in oral argument?
No, not at all. I can only explain what I'm doing, which is when I ask lawyers tough questions, it's to give them an opportunity to explain their positions on both sides and to persuade me that they're right. I do know that in the Second Circuit, because we only give litigants 10 minutes of oral argument each, that the processes in the Second Circuit are different than in most other circuits across the country, and that some lawyers do find that our court, which is not just me, but our court generally is described as a hot bench. It's a term of art lawyers use. It means that they're peppered with questions. Lots of lawyers who are unfamiliar with the process in the Second Circuit find that tough bench difficult and challenging.
If I may interject, Judge, they find you difficult and challenging more than your colleagues. And the only reason I mention this is it stands out when you know, there are many positive things about you, and these hearings are designed to talk about the good and the bad. And I never liked appearing before a judge that I thought was a bully. It's hard enough being a lawyer, having your client there to begin with, without the judge just beating you up for no good reason. Do you think you have a temperament problem?
No, sir. I can only talk about what I know of my relationship with the judges of my court and with the lawyers who appear regularly from our circuit. And I believe that my reputation is such that I ask the hard questions, but I do it evenly for both sides.
In fairness to you, there are plenty of statements in the record in support of you as a person that do not go down this line. But I would just suggest to you, for what it's worth, Judge, as you go forward here, that these statements about you are striking. They're not about your colleagues. You know, the 10-minute rule applies to everybody. And that, you know, obviously you've accomplished a lot in your life, but maybe these hearings are time for self-reflection. This is pretty tough stuff that you don't see from about other judges on the Second Circuit.
Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, we've gathered people together to talk about what happened today. NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, who covers the court, and, of course, confirmation hearings. In fact, confirmation hearings for everybody who's on the court now. Also, our senior Washington editor, Ron Elving, and Tom Goldstein, who has often appeared before the High Court. He's a founder of SCOTUSblog.com and a partner at the law firm Akin Gump. Everybody, welcome back. Let me just ask you about Lindsey Graham. Did that seem to you to be provoking sort of line of questioning?
You know, he said this about her when he came out after meeting her. And he said it even more brutally then in some ways.
And so, fair warning. She's had fair warning.
Fair warning. And I did a whole piece about this. And one of the curious things about it is he accurately read from the Almanac of the Federal Judiciary. But the ratings that she has gotten for every year she's been on the bench up until the most recent set of ratings were not like that. There weren't those bullying kinds of comments. And I called the folks who put this together, and I said, how many people do you interview for this? They said basically between 8 and 12 for each judge. So you have to figure, if she got unlucky for a few of them, but it is quite striking how different those comments were from the difference from the comments that were in previous evaluations.
I wonder about, you know, Lindsey Graham was talking about the other day about meltdown. He said, unless you melt down, you're going to be confirmed. Do you think was he hoping for a meltdown, do you think, Ron Elving?
I think a lot of her supporters are going to feel that way. There was a flurry and a blizzard, really, of blog entries and people Twittering and people sending notes back and forth to each other. I'm sure Tom must have gotten quite a few on his blog from people saying, hey, what's he trying to do? He's goading her. He's needling her. He's trying to get the meltdown that he was talking about. And, you know, the truth is Lindsey Graham is the kind of guy who would treat just about anybody this way and has treated other people much this same way. I don't know that he's really expecting to get a meltdown. I think he finds it gratifying to him as a guy who's been a lawyer, been a judge in the military system, to test other people who come before him in this way. He did something very similar, actually, with Justice Alito when Justice Alito was before him in the confirmation hearings. And he did it mocking, I think, the Democratic critics of Judge Alito, but he did it in such an effective way that was the moment at which Judge Alito's wife had had enough and left the hearing room, in tears. She was so upset by what was going on. So, you know, Lindsey's kind of making himself the star again, at least on the emotional dimension of these hearings.
Tommy, what about this? What about this approach of Lindsey Graham?
Well, I do think he's been the most candid. He said, look, he's basically signaled that he's going to vote for her, but he's really trying to explain what the worries are and wants to give her a chance to answer them. He talks about the question of temperament. He goes back to her speeches and he says, look, I have seen you and I'm impressed by you. I've looked at your decisions and they are center left, which you're not who I would pick, but it doesn't cause me to worry horribly. But I look at the speeches and I think, gosh, you're not going to be constrained as a justice of the Supreme Court in the way you are on the Court of Appeals. That's why we're worried. Can you understand that? And he gives her a chance to answer. I do think a lot of the criticism of her demeanor has sort of gender overtones. I don't think that the men who are judges would get this kind of criticism. She's no more aggressive than John Roberts and Justice Scalia, that's for sure. And I think that, that's a big part of that particular issue.
The other thing is that her colleague and her friend, Guido Calabresi, who is who taught her when he was a professor at Yale Law School, said he had heard this, and he kept book on it, when he would sit on panels with her, and he would sort of rate his own questions, other men's questions, and her questions, and he didn't see any difference. And I think he said something to me that we used on the air, something like, this was sexism in its most obvious form. Now, he's a friend of hers.
Okay, all right. But basically, you all think she's still on the same track she was on before.
Yeah, and I don't even think Lindsey Graham honestly was trying to take her off track. I think he realizes that she's going to be confirmed, but wants to put in front of her the real concerns that are out there. I absolutely agree with Ron that he likes testing people. He likes the directness of it, the prosecutorial role of it. But at the same time, I think it's perfectly clear to him and everybody else in the room that she's going to be confirmed.
Well, and as a conservative Republican who may vote for her, he needs to build both a case for why he would vote for her and also have something to say to all those who will object to that vote and say, look, I got out the issues. I confronted her on all these points that are upsetting you. I did everything I could do in the face of the numbers. She's going to be confirmed. I want to get this all on the record. I want to get her to own up.
Well, now, I would like to go back now to some of the issues that were discussed today that we haven't heard about yet. Probably the most important is that firefighter's case that's been widely reported. It's called the Ritchie case, after the lead plaintiff, isn't that right?
Frank Ritchie.
It deals with a test that firefighters in New Haven had to take to be promoted. The city looked at the results of the test and discovered that minority firefighters did not do well on the test and therefore were not being promoted. So the city tried to devise a different test. White firefighters sued. The case reached Judge Sotomayor's court. Her three-judge panel ruled against the white firefighters. The case went up to the Supremes, and they ruled in favor of the white firefighters. Now, I hope I've stated that accurately. Mm-hmm. What is the importance of the Ritchie case for Sotomayor?
Well, it's sort of the symbolic race case for her. And her, I suppose, bad luck that the Supreme Court decided it and reversed her a matter of only weeks ago. And it's a, quote, reverse discrimination case and a very sympathetic one for the white firefighters. The lead white firefighter, Frank Ritchie, was dyslexic, had spent a lot of his own money to train himself for this test and was among the highest scoring. And then the city tosses out the exam. And so it's about the best that they've got in some ways, except that, of course, today she said repeatedly that the Supreme Court gave us a new standard. We didn't have that standard. I was abiding by the old standard and the standard in my circuit.
So she's making a sort of a technical answer. I'm a technical sort of judge. I have a precedent. I follow it.
Right. Yeah, the other thing that didn't go well for Republicans, I think, is that Ritchie resonates at a 50,000-foot level. Americans don't like the idea of somebody who passed a test on merit not getting the benefit of that when it comes to a judge. But today, so that we can have that conversation in 30 seconds. In fact, we just did. But if you want to instead spend a day on it, you do what Orrin Hatch did, and you get into the weeds about mm-hmm. disparate impact and disparate treatment and different Second Circuit precedents, and nobody has an earthly idea what it is that you're talking about. And so their real problem today was trying to take the next step with the case to try and build a case against her on the basis of it. And that kind of just got very confusing.
I wanted to ask you, Tom, about reversing Judge Sotomayor. She seemed a little bit sensitive on the subject of reversals. Is she reversed often?
She is not reversed often. There are lies, damn lies, and statistics, so bear with me.
He's about to get in the weeds.
Right. I'm going to try not to. She's had bunches of cases. 3,000 cases is a lot of cases, right? And so if she gets reversed, as she has roughly a half dozen times over that long a career, that is not a lot, because the Supreme Court really doesn't usually grant reviewing cases to affirm and say, what a great job, and give courts of appeals judges a pat on the back. So she gets reversed not that many times, and in about 3 out of 4 times that her cases go up to the Supreme Court, she gets reversed. That's the ordinary number. You can, if you say she gets reversed a lot, then you'd have to say that Sam Alito got reversed 100% of the time. But of course, that too is an incredibly small number of cases. There's no serious...
One.
Yeah, or two, I think. Two, but...
Lost in both.
The thing is that there is no serious argument that's being made that she's intellectually not up to the job or she's not a careful judge. That they aren't even trying to press that case. So the whole reversal statistics thing hasn't gone anywhere.
You know, okay, now here I come again on explaining the law to the lawyers. Another fairly technical issue, takings. That is legalese for private property being taken over for some kind of public use. Condemning tracts of privately owned land to create a public park might be an example of that. The current court made a fairly controversial decision in the case of Kelo versus New London, Connecticut, that the city could take a piece of property away from one private owner and give it to another private owner for what the court called a public purpose. Does somebody want to explain why that's a departure? Don't all jump in at once.
Well, the Supreme Court has criticized. Property rights advocates think that this gave a license for states to engage in a lot and localities to engage in a lot of eminent domain and just kind of make up a public purpose, like, I'd like to have a shopping center. That's a public purpose. And she had a case that followed the Kelo case right on its heels that also gave a very broad reading and of the government's power. And she explained that today on highly technical legal grounds, saying, oh, the lawsuit was filed too late. And this is emblematic of the problem that Republicans have. There are 6 hot-button issues. Abortion, she hasn't ruled on. Affirmative action, there's just the Ricci case. Religion, nothing. Gay rights, nothing. This property rights case, she explains on very technical grounds. And she did the same thing with gun rights today. They just haven't been able to grab hold and say, aha, uh-huh, we got it. You're a liberal with a capital L, and you're just out of the mainstream.
And that, so they can only call on her speeches for that.
Yes.
Well, that's right. And with respect to the Ricci case, I think the place that they have not quite closed the circle is relating some of the things that she has said in her speeches that they object to as being racist to the decision that was made in this case, which they regard as reverse racist. So if they can somehow manage to get over that gap, then they might be making more of a compelling case that she is in some sense or another going to get on the court and then suddenly work very hard to turn the law against white people and white males, such as the Judiciary Committee members.
Judge Sessions, Senator Sessions talked about how those opinions might flower.
Yes, but again, this is something you can't prove. And, you know, her greatest strength is also a bit of her weakness. Her greatest strength is that she is the quintessential Court of Appeals judge, that she is just carrying out precedent as set down by the Supreme Court. And it's very technical. That leads to the other part. It's also very boring. And she has not been what you would call the charm candidate. She's been a very nice lady up there, explaining her views and explaining very complicated legal decisions. But she hasn't made any real jokes, and she's not lovable.
Well, she's not Sandra Day O'Connor. She's not Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She's not one of the guys, so it probably doesn't work for her to do one of the guys kinds of humor. I think, actually, one of the things that's working for her is that this attempt to make her sound as some kind of emotional character, a woman, or if you would, you know, perhaps a Latina, and carries with it a certain implication of somebody who is emotional or hot-blooded, perhaps. And I think there was a little bit of that going on today, too. None of that works when you watch her because she is so deliberate and so measured.
But people at the White House, kept saying we would see how warm she is. I think we see what a very strong lawyer she is. But warm, no.
Well, there is, of course, the sort of double row of people who are all very fond of her who've come to the hearings with her. And that, I suppose, counts for something, but I'm not sure. But still, I do think what I'm hearing is that we all agree she's not gotten into much trouble so far in the hearing, and it looks as though tomorrow we're going to hear more of the same. We've been talking about the Supreme Court nominee, Judge Sonia Sotomayor of New York, and we've heard from NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving,
From NPR's legal affairs correspondent, Nina Totenberg, and from Washington lawyer Tom Goldstein of Akin Gump, I want to thank all of you for your help and for your wise counsel. I'm Linda Wertheimer. This has been a special report on hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the nomination of Judge Sonia Sotomayor. You're listening to NPR News.